From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Carol Shields, best known for her 1995 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Stone Diaries. 3 years ago, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and is now in stage 4, the final phase of the disease. She expects her new novel will be her last. It's called Unless, and it's about a woman whose relatively happy life has been turned upside down. Shields is the mother of 5 and didn't publish her first novel until she was 40. We'll talk about her life, her writing, and her diagnosis. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Silver Lining, the new CD by Bonnie Raitt, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word chastity and its various meanings through the ages. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fire broke out at the besieged Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem today as Israeli troops exchanged gunfire with Palestinian fighters who've been inside the church compound for nearly a month. Flames were seen coming out of 3 rooms in the Orthodox Christian and Franciscan sections of the church, about 50 feet from the spot that's the traditional birthplace of Jesus. Officials say at least 3 people were slightly injured trying to put out the fire. It's not clear what started the shooting or the fire. Israeli forces are still in a standoff, with some of the gunmen remaining in the church saying that they must either surrender or be sent into exile. The Bush administration has expressed regret that Israel and the United Nations failed to reach an agreement that would have allowed a UN mission to investigate what happened when Israeli troops invaded the Jenin refugee camp. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan told the Security Council today that he plans to disband the mission. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Annan delivered his message in a letter to the council as it met to discuss the standoff with Israel. Israel's cabinet repeatedly delayed the UN mission, raising concerns about the makeup of the UN team and the scope of its work. Among other demands, the Israelis wanted to make sure soldiers who are questioned will be protected from prosecution. Palestinians initially accused Israeli troops of killing hundreds of people in the assault on Jenin, though so far about 50 bodies have been recovered. The Bush administration supported a UN mission as a way to get the facts and tried to negotiate an agreement between the UN and Israel. U.S. officials at the UN say they will now go along with Annan's decision and plan to focus on getting humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Jenin. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
On Capitol Hill today, Republicans and Democrats announced rival election year plans to help defray the costs of prescription drugs. The benefit was a campaign promise made by both parties in the last election. NPR's David Wellner reports from Capitol Hill.
House Republicans promised that by the end of this month, they will have acted on a prescription drug benefit. Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert.
We're determined to get it done now, early enough in the legislative season, so the Senate has enough time to act in order to get a final bill to the president's desk before we adjourn this fall.
GOP sponsors say the plan would cost $350 billion over the next 10 years, twice what the White House wants to spend. Today, Senate Democrat Zell Miller offered a rival plan costing more than $400 billion.
This is a very bold new program, I believe, that reaches all seniors. It's designed to provide the greatest assistance to those who need it most, and I think it's affordable.
Majority Leader Tom Daschle expects the Senate to act on prescription drugs by August. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 113 points to close at 10,059 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft says he's supporting a new bill that's aimed at preventing so-called virtual child pornography. The new bill is designed to eliminate objections that led the Supreme Court to overturn a similar law last month. The court said that although the government could prosecute pornography that involved real children or teenagers, it could not prohibit material in which computers had been used to simulate the appearance of children. The new bill would ban the production, distribution, and possession of images of children engaging in sex, whether they're real or virtual. A grand jury in New Jersey has indicted former NBA All-Star Jason Williams on manslaughter charges in connection with a shooting at his home earlier this year. Andrew Meyer reports from member station WBGO in Newark.
The grand jury handed up charges, including aggravated and reckless manslaughter and witness and evidence tampering. The indictment comes more than 2 months after limo driver Kostas Christofi was shot and killed at Williams Rural, New Jersey estate. Prosecutors say it happened while Williams was recklessly handling a shotgun. They say he and two friends then tried to make the shooting look like a suicide. Williams appeared in court on the charges back in March, but entered no plea at the time. A spokeswoman for Williams says he will plead not guilty at the appropriate time. No date has been set for his arraignment, and he remains free on $270,000 bail. Williams was once among the NBA's best rebounders, but leg injuries cut his career short. He's currently suspended from his job as an NBA analyst for NBC. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Meyer in Newark.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ lost 10 points to close at 1,677. The S&P 500 gained 9 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Carol Shields, is best known for her novel, The Stone Diaries, which won a 1995 Pulitzer Prize as well as a National Book Critics Circle Award. It was a bestseller in the States and a popular choice for book clubs. Success came as a surprise to Shields. She's the mother of five, started writing late, and didn't even publish her first novel until the age of 40. She compensated by writing 10 novels, 2 collections of short stories, and a biography of Jane Austen. She spent most of her life in Canada. Her husband Don was dean at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. 2 years ago, they moved to Victoria, British Columbia. Now at the age of 66, Carol Shields has stage 4 breast cancer. After she was diagnosed, she started writing her new novel, which she expects will be her last. It's called Unless, and it's about a woman whose life is suddenly changed from relative happiness to despair when her oldest daughter falls off the track of normal life. The main character, Rita, is a 43-year-old woman in a comfortable marriage with 3 teenage daughters. Rita is a moderately successful writer about to begin a new novel when her life is turned upside down. Here's the first paragraph.
It happens that I'm going through a period of great unhappiness and loss just now. All my life I've heard people speak of finding themselves in acute pain, bankrupt in spirit and body, but I've never understood what they meant. To lose, to have lost. I believed these visitations of darkness lasted only a few minutes or hours, and that these saddened people in between bouts were occupied, as we all were, with the useful monotony of happiness. But happiness is not what I thought. Happiness is the lucky pane of glass you carry in your head. It takes all your cunning just to hang on to it. And once it's smashed, you have to move into a different sort of life.
That's Carol Shields reading the opening of her new novel, Unless. Was the idea of great unhappiness and loss as foreign to you as it is to your main character, Rita?
Yes, I would have to say that's true. An interviewer once asked me what was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. This was somewhere in the States a few years ago. And I said, it hasn't happened yet. I couldn't think of it. But a short while after that, I had a daughter going to school at Cambridge, and she was hit by a truck. She was hit so hard that the windshield shattered on her head, and she survived that accident, in fact, came through very well. But when I think of that, and of course the breath leaves my body when I think of it, that would be the great unhappiness.
I thought you were going to say the great unhappiness was your illness. I didn't realize that had happened to you.
Well, yes, of course, and then this, but otherwise, I suppose I've lived quite a fortunate life. But when I was 63, I was suddenly diagnosed with breast cancer. And then I did have to, it did change my life from before this cancer to after the cancer. I did, of course, as everyone does, I did a lot of grieving about this and trying to pull myself back together so that I could become a working writer and a working, functioning person again.
Was it hard to write again? To find, like, the focus and the interest in something outside of your own story and your own symptoms and your own prognosis?
Yes, it was very hard to start writing again. Fortunately, I did have a deadline for a book of short stories that was to be delivered March the 1st. I spent about a month not writing, not thinking. Thinking that the world does not need another book, particularly a book that I might write. But I, what I found was, oddly enough, was that it was something to do with myself. I had a job of work to do, and it really didn't matter what it was. I could go to my office, and I could work. And so it turned out to be a distraction, and quite a wonderful distraction.
In your novel, the main character's teenage daughter is living on a street corner under a lamppost wearing a cardboard sign on her chest that says, "Goodness." She's living basically like a homeless person, not bathing. Her hair is all matted. In your book, the characters come up with different theories, usually different feminist theories, about
yes.
why this daughter has made herself into a homeless person and sitting with that sign that says, "Goodness," around her chest. The mother
yes.
thinks, well, maybe it's because... As a woman, she's capable of thinking of goodness, but not of reaching greatness, because a woman's role is so circumscribed in the world now. And then another feminist writer thinks that Nora has simply succumbed to the traditional role of women without power. She's accepted in its stead complete powerlessness, total passivity, a kind of impotent piety. In doing nothing, she has claimed everything. You know, of course, I hope I'm not giving too much away here to say that their theories are really wrong. Do you see this book in part as being about the limitations of using social theory or feminist theory to actually understand what goes on in a person's mind?
Yes. I think, in fact, all the people who offer advice are both right and both wrong, all wrong. That is, what has led to this estrangement and this behavior is all of those things. I remember when I was a child, my childhood was in the 40s, early 30s, late 30s and early 40s. I remember my mother sitting down with the three children at the kitchen table and saying to us, "You can be anything you want, even President of the United States." And I knew, I must have been about 8 years old, I knew that wasn't true. And I knew she knew it wasn't true. It was what people said. And my own daughter, who has a daughter herself, wonders what she can say to her daughter about what she will be allowed to be and do, how much actual freedom, how much of her own life she can take hold of. So those were all the things that I was thinking about.
Rita, the main character in your novel, who's a mother and a writer, she's very conscious of being a woman writer. And she believes that sadly, men aren't interested in women's lives and that women's fiction isn't taken as seriously as men's fiction. Has that been your experience as a writer?
Yes, that has been my experience, that that women writers tend not to be taken as seriously as male writers.
How have you felt that in your career?
Well, in a sense, I haven't objected. I mean, when people say, for example, that I am a women's writer, I mean, what does that mean, really? Does it mean I write about women? Certainly, that is true. I do. Are my readers women? Well, yes. I think there are more male readers than there used to be, but I know that the readers of my fiction are mostly women of different ages and. So if that's what it means to be a woman writer, what I was concerned about is that women characters are so seldom placed as the moral center of the novel. And if one puts a male character there instead of a woman, the novel always seems to be taken more seriously. Now, you can look at Jane Austen's novels, of course, as great exceptions. I think they are. I think the women are, however, they're certainly the center of those novels. And they were the first novels I ever read, by the way, in which there were intelligent women. But the of course, these women want to secure them marriages for themselves, advantageous marriages. And one thinks at that point is where they lose their moral authority that they have built up in the book. I think it's very hard writing novel seriously about serious women.
As your main character is writing her comic novel about Alicia and Roman, the couple she's writing about, she says, I must start thinking seriously about Alicia and Roman's sex life. I have to be braver about it this time around. An awful maidenly daintiness runs through the pages of my previous book, a prudery that has nothing to do with sex in the 21st century. What are some of the difficulties you've faced in your books writing about sex? What are some of the stages you've gone through in trying to figure out how to do it?
How do you do it? Well, the problem is the language of sex is so eroded. There are just so many phrases. This is why they have these marvelous competitions to find out who writes the worst sex scene of the year. It's very hard to write about something like this. And then he pressed his lips against her. Then he kissed her full on the mouth, etc., etc. To do it freshly, to do it again, I found that difficult. I found it difficult because of my generation, because I am now 66, and I came through the period where I think Ernest Hemingway was not allowed to say damn in his novels. He had to say darn. Those were the books I was reading. Sex was veiled pretty much from us. And then I was always thinking, of course, conscious of the fact that I had children, and I had children who went to school, and I was concerned about them thinking about their mother writing sex scenes. I realize this sounds a bit ridiculous, but I did go through that.
What did you think it would say about you if your children found out that mom wrote sex scenes?
I think they would have been embarrassed with, among their friends. So I wrote sort of around the sex scenes instead of directly into them.
In your book, The Stone Diaries, the novel that won the Pulitzer Prize, you're following the life of a woman who's born in 1905 and lives to the age of 85. So it covers most of the 20th century, but because she's born in 1905, she's actually very I shouldn't say because she's born then, but you're talking about generations. You know, her generational style was to be very uncomfortable with sexuality. I think for her, sex was more of a mysterious duty than anything else. Was it easy for you to find her point of view about sex and to write about her point of view?
I had a mother born in 1902, and I remember my mother did very well compared to most mothers, talking about such things. I remember that she took us to the Art Institute in Chicago, and she told us before we went in very carefully that we would be seeing unclothed men and women statues in the Art Institute, and that the human body was a beautiful thing. But at home, she dressed in the closet. And so there was another side to her. And I never thought of this as hypocrisy. I felt she was trying to work this out in her own mind and just had a little trouble getting it all together. She did very well, I think, in talking to us about sex. I think she did better than I did with my children, in fact. But there was a lot that she missed. And I don't know if I should say this, but I can remember when I was packing for my honeymoon, this would be 1957, and the honeymoon was a week long. She wanted to make sure I had 7 nightgowns because she said, rather obliquely, it's actually awfully messy. So that was the message I got about the sexual life that awaited me.
So has writing about sexuality become more comfortable over the years for you?
Well, I don't do it as well as some people do. I think other people are able to do it better than I do. But I do realize that it is part of all our lives, and you really can't miss it out altogether.
Well, I will say that in your new book, the main character is very comfortable with sex and really seems to enjoy it with her husband. Not that that's at the center of the book, but it's almost like a sanctuary for them in this terrible time. It's
yes.
something that they can still partake in and appreciate.
Yes, yes. So perhaps you're saying it has got easier. And of course, my children have grown up, and
that's right.
And we're living in a different era.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My guest is writer Carol Shields, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Stone Diaries. Her new novel is called Unless. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Carol Shields is my guest. She's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Stone Diaries. Her new book is a novel called Unless. The Stone Diaries is set in the past. It begins in around 1905 and continues through most of the 20th century. Do you feel like you were able to use a different voice from your contemporary fiction voice because this novel is about an older woman and because so much of it is set in an earlier part of the 20th century?
Yes, what you're talking about actually gave me enormous pleasure in the writing of this book. And I don't think I ever wrote with more happiness than when I wrote the Stone Diaries. I did feel that sense of a period phrase. I can remember, for example, my mother sang to us, lickety-split, and I remember saying it to my children, but my children don't say it. And so I was very interested in finding period phrases and getting them into the right era. And do you know the expression, I'll see you in the movies?
No.
It means just, I'll see you around. And I didn't know when that came into currency, but one of my colleagues at the university was able to pin that one down for me to 1929. So I was interested in that kind of thing and the style of writing. But the book is really about life filtered through Daisy Goodwill's own brain.
She's the main character.
She's the main character through her consciousness. She was a woman who cared deeply what other people thought about her. And so everything, all the other voices are really filtered through her consciousness. So that was a very interesting psychological puzzle, and it also involved a kind of historical puzzle because people did speak and wrote letters very differently in 1910 than they did later on. And I read magazines. I read some old newspapers, especially the society columns, to get a sense of that voice and that period sound.
In addition to phrases that are now are archaic, what are some of the differences you found in conversation and writing style from the early 1900s?
Well, people mostly were more formal in their speech, but of course they were more silent. I always think that the greatest tragedy of our parents' lives, people of my generation, is that so much went unsaid, unspoken, unshared. So many silences, such fear of emotion, such fear of breaking taboos. I don't honestly believe that the consciousness of an early 20th century person is very much different than the consciousness of today's society. But I think the language is different, the use of language, the sparsity of language between people, the number of things that weren't in the narrative, that were left out of the narrative.
A lot of reading groups, book clubs, chose your book as a book to read. And in fact, at the back of one of the paperback editions of the Stone Diaries, there are questions that reading groups can use as discussion points. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about having
I feel very negative about that. Uh-huh. I think anyone who picks up a book should not have to get to a quiz at the end of it. And I never had it again and never want to. They do the book club guides now, of course, over the internet. But I don't like the idea of this being bound into the book. It changes the book as we know it and the shape of the book, the arc of the book. So I don't think it's a good idea. I belong to a book club. We wouldn't have used a reader's guide for anything in the world.
Why not?
Well, we set our own agenda.
Right.
We had our own questions, our own experiences to bring to the reading. I think we would have felt put upon. But I know I also know people who welcome that kind of direction.
Carol Shields is the author of the new novel, Unless. She won a 1995 Pulitzer Prize for her novel, The Stone Diaries. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, motherhood, feminism, and writing. We continue our conversation with Carol Shields. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Bonnie Raitt's new CD, Silver Lining, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers a word that's making a comeback, chastity. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Carol Shields. Her best-selling novel, The Stone Diaries, won a 1995 Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Critics Circle Award. Her new novel, Unless, was written after she was diagnosed with breast cancer. It's about a 43-year-old wife, mother, and writer who is experiencing profound unhappiness for the first time in her life. Shields is the author of 10 novels, but she didn't get started until relatively late. Her first novel was published when she was 40. You were married when you were 22, and you had 5 children in 10 years. Did you fall in love with motherhood?
I loved motherhood. People were having large families. This was through the 60s. I loved children. I was interested in children. I would say it was a wonderful period of my life. I think I thought it would go on forever, but of course it doesn't. The children gradually become more and more independent and gradually and quite quickly, leave home. So I've had an empty nest since 1985.
Uh-huh. That's when the last child left home?
Yeah, yes.
And how did you discover feminism?
I discovered feminism late. I came to feminism late. I knew there was something wrong. I just didn't know what it was. But of course, I, like many American women, I read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, and I have to say, it was like a thunderbolt. I was astonished. I had no idea women thought like that, or women could be anything other than what they were. That was in the early 60s. I read that book. It did change the way I thought about myself. I did begin to do a graduate degree part-time. Thought about doing some writing. It gave me courage.
Is that when you started writing?
Yes. It was about the same time, and that was probably something of a coincidence of time that my fifth child, and she was going half days to school. And I just had a little bit of time, and I was writing poetry in those days. I was very interested in poetry for about 5 years, in reading it and writing it. And eventually, these were just published in small magazines in Canada. One of the professors at the University of Ottawa said, "Well, look, we're in the publishing business. If you have 50 poems, we'll publish a book." So that, in fact, is what they did. And then they published another book 2 years later. So I had the two early books of poetry before I sat down to write a novel.
As much as you loved being a mother, as a mother,
yes,
of 5 who was just kind of discovering feminism and discovering that you liked to write and had a gift for writing, did you ever resent all the responsibilities of motherhood?
No. I can't think now why I didn't resent it. You know, the lives of middle-class women of my generation were rather predictable. The idea that we would marry, even those of us who had a degree, we would marry, we would have children, we would have dinner parties. I didn't know women who did really other things. So I expected that I would do this. It was a very happy period of my life. I have to say this. I think I had very nice children. It doesn't seem to me that it was a difficult period. There were people all around me doing the same thing. My women friends, my coffee clutch friends were all doing this too. And I sometimes think that the old coffee clutch idea is belittled. But for us, this was the beginning of feminism for many of us. This is where we talked about these things for the first time.
How did you find time to write as the mother of 5, particularly when your children were young?
You know, everyone asks me this, including my own children. But what my children forget is that I did not have a job. So they're all raising children and having jobs, but I didn't have a job. So I didn't write until they went to school. And I didn't write on weekends. And I didn't write in the evening. None of this was possible. But I used to try to get that hour just before they came home for lunch, 11 to 12. You know, got all the socks picked up, etc. And then I tried to write a couple of pages. That was all I ever asked myself to do. Then sometimes in the afternoon, before they came home from school, I would get back to those two pages and maybe have a chance to do them over again. But I really only had about an hour or an hour and a half a day. But it's funny because now I have the whole day and my output is no more than it was then. But this was how I organized that time, that I would give myself, I wanted two pages a day. And if I didn't get to my two pages, I would get into bed at night with one of those those thick yellow tablets of lined paper. And I would do two quick pages and then turn off the light. Mm-hmm. And so that I did this for 9 months. And at the end of 9 months, I had a novel. And I never wrote as quickly again. I never wrote in such an organized way again. But it was, I could see how it could be done in little units. I thought of it like boxcars. I had 9 boxcars, and each chapter had a title, starting with September, and then October, November, December. So it was a very easy structure for someone writing a first novel to follow.
And is that the novel that was published, Small Ceremony?
Yes, yes.
So you were 40 when that was actually published?
Yes, I was.
My guest is writer Carol Shields, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Stone Diaries. Her new novel is called Unless. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Carol Shields is my guest. She's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Stone Diaries. Her new novel is called Unless. I know that you have stage 4 breast cancer. Can I ask, like, how your health is?
Well, I'm not in very good health. I do have, I'm in under care here in Victoria. My cancer was discovered rather late. And I've had several recurrences, so I'm not in particularly good health now.
Was it an act of faith to start a novel and expect to live at least until the end of it? Or were you given a kind of good enough prognosis that that wasn't an issue?
I wanted something to do. I wanted work to do. I didn't think I could finish it. My last few novels have been rather long. This one is a little shorter. And then I had a surgical procedure which gave me 3 excellent months where some of my old energy came back to me. So I had those months to finish the novel. And I was astonished that at the end of August, one day I looked up and I realized I had finished the novel. And I was so happy. I wanted to run out in the street and give people money and take in their mending. I don't remember ever finishing a novel and being so happy about it. And I suppose, I don't know, it was a marvelous blessing.
Illness often changes a person's relationship to religion and making them either more or less inclined to have faith. In the Stone Diaries, in talking about the religious impulse, the main character says, "There are ecstatics like my father who become addicted to the rarefied air of spiritual communion. And there are cooler minds who claim that religion exists in order to keep us from feeling our own absurdity." Where do you fit in there? And do you feel like you've been changed by cancer in terms of your own sense of religion or lack of faith?
I was brought up in the Methodist Church in the United States, and then to the United Church in Canada, and then became a Quaker, and then became nothing. I still call myself a Quaker because, although I don't go to a meeting any longer, but I feel a certain kinship and nostalgia for my Protestant background and those that shared it, that whole community. But I haven't been a believer for a long time, and I think I always knew in one way or another that that it was a metaphor, that the Old Testament was this sort of metaphor of beginning, and the New Testament a metaphor for beginning again. And I think I always knew that. I wasn't able to manage the other beliefs.
I want to read you another sentence from the Stone Diaries, and this is from a chapter that takes place in 1985 when the main character is 80 years old, and she says, "Suddenly her body is all that matters. How it's let her down, and how fundamentally lonely it is to live inside a body year after year and carry it always in a forward direction, and how there is never any relief from the weight of it, even when sleeping, even when joined briefly to the body of another." How does that read to you now?
It reads to me like something I would say today. The body that we live in, the changing body, the aging body, the ailing body. I think we're very conscious. We can't really get away from it. I suppose we have to find a place of protection. And think as well of ourselves as we can during this particular period.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are very concerned with having a legacy and artistic output that will outlive them. Now that you are ill, does it matter any more or less to you that you will have your books as a legacy?
You know, people think that would make a difference. People say this to me, at least you've written your books. The kind of people who say, what have I done in my life, etc. But the fact is, I don't think that. I'm a realist, and I know the shelf life of a book is about 4 months. The day that I got the Pulitzer Prize, I met Margot Jefferson. And she said, "You know what this means, don't you?" And I said, "No, what?" And she said, "You already know the first line of your obituary." And, of course, I do. And that I found that rather frightening. But someone sent me a list of all the Pulitzer Prize winners since something like 1915, I think. And half of them I'd never heard of. Half of them. So I don't think literary reputations live on. Very few of them. Books, you know, fall out of the public eye. So I don't have a sense of leaving anything permanent at all. I suppose one thinks of one's children as what you leave permanently, and their children. Naturally, I like to write books that people enjoy reading, but the literary legacy, no, it's very unimportant to me.
Mm-hmm. I know you're not well. I know you have cancer. Are you afraid of death?
No, I'm not afraid of death. I've had three years, kind of bonus years, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just one instant away from being alive. I don't think it's far away at all. And I'm not afraid of it at all, or anything involved with it.
Well, Carol Shields, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I wish you the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Carol Shields is the author of The Stone Diaries and the new novel, Unless. Bonnie Raitt has a new CD called Silver Lining. After 15 albums, 3 decades on the road, and an induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, she might be expected to play variations on the music that made her popular. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that Raitt's new CD is a rarity, an album that extends its creator's music into new areas.
I got a new thing, not like the last one. This is an upgrade minor, the kind that really blows my mind. Back in the fast lane.
Bonnie Raitt's not kidding when she says she's got a new thing, not like the old thing. She's managed to combine every aspect of her long career into one gleaming new collection. Singer-songwriter sensitivity, rock and roll carousing, and bluesy melancholy vary the themes, while the music surrounding them is supplied by her road band with an immediacy that's very hard to pull off in the recording studio. Lots of times, Silver Lining sounds like a live album that lacks only a live audience.
Something smells good, baby.
Over the years, Raitt has most often relied on other songwriters for her best-known material, from Sippy Wallace's You Got to Know How to John Hiatt's Thing Called Love, but her own compositions, though sporadic, have often been celebratory in the manner of something to talk about. The song I just played, called Gnawin' on It, is something new for her, a blues with blue humor, written from a male point of view. Either that or Bonnie's met a woman she really likes a lot. In any case, the song is only the most brazen example of how loose and goosey she's allowed herself to become on this collection.
Well, I went and gave away my TV, told a man cut off the phone. I put an ad in the paper, baby, gonna sell everything I own. Done everything in the world I know to try and make it through. But there's just no getting over you. Well, I went and bought myself a new straw hat with one eye poking under the brim. I bought myself a little seaside shack in case I might just want.
Silver Lining is a very shrewd, thought-out record. There are pop songs for people who got on board only as of 1989 with her multi-Grammy winner Nick of Time. But she's also reaching out to her baby boomer demographic by making room for her old friend Freebo and his tuba on the song I just played, No Getting Over You. And she summons up the sound of Lowell George and Little Feet in her guitar playing on Fool's Game.
Bad mistake, a crying shame. Get caught playing a damn fool's game. Bad mistake is a crying shame. Get caught playing a damn fool's game. Oh, yeah. Stop and think about what you want to do. Then take a good look at what's looking real.
Now in her 50s, Bonnie Raitt has become the blues mama she used to emulate as a Quaker-raised slide guitar Boston folky when she started out. Nowadays, she uses the voice of her great, eternally underrated percussionist Ricky Fattar and the guitarist Andy Abad to plumb African rhythms on a couple of cuts. I'll admit it. After her last record, 1998's Fundamental, I feared that Bonnie Raitt would never repeat the artistic success she had with producer Don Was in the late 80s. But having graduated from Was's pop school, she's doing post-grad work on her own in sober romance and giddy sensuousness. She's here to teach us her own lessons.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bonnie Raitt's new CD, Silver Lining. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the history of the word chastity. This is Fresh Air. Chastity sounds like an old-fashioned word, but it's been in the news a lot recently in connection with both the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church and the abstinence-only movement in schools. But according to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, the word doesn't mean what it used to.
These are hard times for chastity. As the Pope said, the life of chastity confutes the conventional wisdom of the world. And Eugene Clark, the rector of St. Patrick's Cathedral, pointed to the difficulties that priests have in maintaining their vows in a sex-saturated society where Americans are bombarded by images of liberated sex all day long. But chastity was problematic for both the church and society at large well before Hugh Hefner and Larry Flint filed their first business plans. You can see that in the declining use of the words chaste and chastity themselves. In modern times, those words tend to be used chiefly in a metaphorical way. You see a lot more references to chaste architecture or a chaste prose style than to chaste men and women. That decline in the fortunes of chaste and chastity is understandable enough. We moderns are uncomfortable about using words that associate sexual continence with spiritual purity. We've lost sight of the connection that used to be implicit in words like chasten and chastise, which originally had the senses make chaste or purify. For that matter, the word castrate is taken from the same Latin root. It's just a more draconian way of getting at the same end. Not surprisingly, the eclipse of chastity has led to a certain fuzziness about the original meaning of the word. It's true that chastity has always involved abstaining from illicit sex. But chastity wasn't the same thing as virginity. You could become chaste even if you'd already had sexual experience. As St. Augustine put it in a famous prayer, "Lord, give me chastity and continence, but not now." For that matter, chastity didn't necessarily rule out sex within marriage, so long as it was free of prurience or concupiscence. By the 18th century, though, chastity was regarded as a minor virtue, and one associated chiefly with women, as the secular double standard came into its own. Samuel Johnson wrote dismissively of one vain, insipid country wife that she had no virtue but chastity. And over the last 100 years, people have pretty much bailed out on using the word chaste to describe sexual continence. Instead, they've appropriated the word celibate, which originally meant only unmarried. But some people have been trying to revive the word chastity. On the web, it comes up a lot in the sites for organizations promoting sexual abstinence. That movement's on a roll right now. Just last week, in fact, a House committee authorized an additional $50 million for abstinence-only sex education. This in addition to the $500 million in state and federal funds that the programs have already received. The programs encourage teens to swear off sex until marriage and provide no information about birth control, abortion, or gay and lesbian sex on the grounds that that might put ideas into adolescents' heads. The sites of the abstinence-only groups warn adolescents about the dangers of condoms and offer them suggestions as to how to restrain their sexual urges. One of them provides helpful links to the Amazon pages where they can order Scrabble and Trivial Pursuit. But trying to resuscitate an unfashionable word is a little like trying to revive an old folk dance or costume. People always get the details wrong. The abstinence-only movement tends to talk about chastity as if it were merely the spiritual concomitant of virginity. And they often talk about the loss of chastity as an irrevocable step. As one group puts it, chastity is a lifestyle. One date may be too late. But the abstinence-only organizations aren't the only ones who are contributing to the comeback of the word chastity. There's an odd mirror of their preoccupations in the websites put up by people who are into chastity as a source of sexual stimulation by means of devices that prevent any kind of sexual activity until the wearer is released by the key holder. For women, the sites offer new variations on the chastity belt, which, by the way, was actually invented during the Italian Renaissance, not the Crusades, and which was probably very rarely used until its rediscovery by modern fetishists. For men, there are a variety of cuffs, sheaths, and cages that achieve an analogous effect by what appear to be calculatedly uncomfortable means. Curiously, enthusiasts like to use the word chastisement to describe the process of putting your associate into one of these contrivances. It isn't the normal use of the word, but it does have etymology on its side. Still, the chastisement sites do capture something of the old sense of chastity as an austere spiritual practice. And unlike the abstinence-only movement, they have something else in common with the church. They don't pretend that chastity is a vocation with universal appeal.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Mones, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the United Nations efforts to rebuild in Afghanistan and the West Bank and Gaza. We talk with Mark Malik Brown, head of the UN's development program. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.